90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Streaming online at www.kkfi.org.
The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the host and guest and do not necessarily reflect those of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, its board, staff, and volunteers.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. Today we are continuing our Black History conversations, and I am honored to have in our studio today Mr. Lewis W. Duguid. And he is an author of three books and a former member of the Kansas City Star editorial board, newspaper columnist, and reporter. And he worked for them for over 30 years. Another fast fact, many people may not know in Kansas City, there's a little bitty house right there off of Brooklyn and Michigan. Right off of 12th and Brooklyn, right next to St. Mark's, that is called the Sarah Rector Mansion. And Sarah Rector was the first African-American millionaire. And she became a millionaire at the age of 7 due to oil in her native state of Oklahoma. So it was there, it was rebuilt. She moved to Kansas City, built the house, and at the time she had a net worth of over $5 million, and this is before, you know, Oprah Winfrey, way before Michael Jordan, before all of the Black millionaires that came after her. She was the pioneer, and that's a part of Kansas City's legacy and history. So good morning, Lewis. Welcome to Cowtown Conversations.
Well, it's good to be here, Joseph. Thanks. Thank you for having me.
Lewis, can you tell listeners a little bit about yourself? Are you originally from Kansas City?
St. Louis is my hometown. I always tell people, but don't hold that against me, because I really love and appreciate being in Kansas City. But that's where I was born. St. Louis is where I was born, raised there. Then went to the University of Missouri, Columbia School of Journalism, and after graduating from there, came to Kansas City in 1977, May, to work for the then Kansas City Times and later the Kansas City Star.
Lewis, you have a very distinguished background. You were a newspaper reporter, diversity facilitator, author, and award-winning columnist. What inspired you to major in journalism?
It actually was a high school English teacher. My junior year, I landed in this one teacher's class, and everybody said, get out, change. She doesn't give good grades. You'll never make it. And I stayed in the class and ended up getting an A. And at the end of the class, she said, you should think about working as a journalist. Well, up to that time, I had been on tours to the Post-Dispatch a couple of times, and I always noticed that the people who worked there just seemed very unhappy, very dour, and of course all white. So I didn't think too much of doing that, but then I thought about what this teacher had said and realized that that would enable me to live out a childhood dream. Well, I grew up literally in a laboratory with my siblings, because Dad is a chemist, PhD, graduate of Cornell University, and he insisted that we go to work when we were kids, when we could hold our bowels, our bladder, and a broom. So at age 3, we were swept into his company and worked emptying the trash and sweeping the floor, and then worked our way up to different other jobs, which included sales. But we were there on weekends, days off, holidays, summer breaks, winter breaks, Thanksgiving breaks. So we didn't really have a life outside of Do Good Chemical, which is the name of the company. So journalism actually gave me a chance to be outside of that company. When I was working for Dad's company, I would always wonder to myself, what are real people doing? What are they thinking? Where are they going? What are their expectations? What's on their mind? And like I said, journalism gave me a chance to actually realize that feeling of what were other people thinking.
Lewis, how long did you work at the Kansas City Star? It was more than 3 decades, but how long did you work there?
39 years, 5 months.
That's what you like me when the military and people when you get to the point where you can tell them the number of years and the number of months. At the end of it, you didn't like working there. You only worked there because you wanted to stay there and needed the pension.
Well, here's the thing. It wasn't that I was looking for something outside of the newspaper. Again, journalism for me was the ability to live out a childhood dream. But it also was an opportunity to really tell the stories of people of color and just people in general in Kansas City. So it was a platform in which I could do many things. Growing up in the sciences, Dad would always quote different giants in the science, and he would quote Archimedes all the time saying, "Give me a long enough board and a place to stand, and I will move the world." Well, the Star was that place to stand. And the board was the talents that I had picked up over the years of being a journalist. And putting that lever in places where that seemed unmovable to others was my opportunity to actually force change.
What type of stories did you write at the Star? I know one of the stories was a series of columns as you followed the class of 1999 at Washington High School. So was education one of the areas that you covered, or what was some of the areas that you covered?
Education, definitely. But in my early years at the newspaper, I covered the police beat. I covered the Jackson County Courthouse. I covered City Hall for a little bit. And the opportunity to move around was really phenomenal because it gave me a chance to learn all of the different parts of this community. I also, because I didn't take the conventional route on doing things, would upset the management at the newspaper. So I ended up, back when the Star had a bureau system, working in every single bureau in the system because I would be downtown and then I'd upset the management and they'd say, "Go out to the Independence Bureau and that's where you're going to stay." Well, the bureau system at the time was one in which you were sentenced and placed there and you weren't going to get out. And you wouldn't get decent stories, so eventually your annual reviews would come in bad, and then you'd be put on probation and you'd leave. But I was young, I was hungry, I would find different things that were worthwhile to write in the different bureau offices, and somebody would say, "Why is he out there? Bring him back downtown." And so I'd get busy downtown, and then these folks would get upset with me there, and they'd say, "Okay, now you go out to the Kansas City, Kansas Bureau and don't come back." And I'd get busy out there, and then they'd bring me back in. And that went on for all 5 of the bureaus that the Star had. The benefit, and this is one thing that I think is important for everyone, particularly your listeners, is that the benefit of being exiled is that you learn about all of the different parts of the metropolitan area, and you can bring that together to really enhance your ability to know the community more and to know what works in different sections of the city. So all of their attempts to do that to me just make me better. stronger. So I learned about Kansas City, Kansas when I was in the Bureau out there. I also learned that this is a community that really cares about its children, its people, just like everywhere else. So when I was given the opportunity to do the series on education, I jumped at it because this was a chance for us to do something different. In journalism, we cover education from the school board perspective, from the administration perspective, from the bad students' perspective, and from the exceptional students' perspective. But we don't cover education as I think parents really would like it to be covered, and that's day-to-day. What's going on day-to-day in the school system? So I had written a piece for, I think it was the Southland section of the newspaper, about an educator in the early 90s. She was in middle school, and she was doing some innovative things with her students and making a connection and doing a good job. And so I wrote about her and her work. She wrote to me in 1995 and said that she was getting out of school teaching because she was really disturbed by how the system had changed in the 20 plus years that she had been an educator. Parents weren't supportive, the administration wasn't supportive, the kids were acting up and really not wanting to connect to education the way that they should have. And she just couldn't take that anymore, and so she was getting out. So I wrote a piece for the start of the 1995 school year saying that we're losing good teachers. And we need to be mindful of how we can be supportive of teachers so that we can keep these individuals. She had a master's degree, and all of that seemed to just disappear. Anyway, after that column was published, I heard from Alice Bennett at Washington High School, and her take in two long, tearful letters was, "Poor little Miss Suburban teacher, she can't take it anymore. She doesn't know what taking it is really like." And she said, it's far worse in an urban school district. And so my habit has always been, if you write to me, I'm going to write you back. And so I wrote her back and said, okay, if things are as bad as you say, then prove it. Let me into your classroom, because I know that teachers can't speak of these things straight out without suffering the consequences and possibly losing their jobs. So open your classroom to me. And let me see for myself just how things are in education. And she did, and that began a four-year-long process of my studying with the class of 1999 from the students' freshman year until they graduated. Alice had six freshman English classes. And so what I would try to do is to get to each one of those classes, and sometimes as many as three, and go to Washington High School at least once a week. But after I'd been there a while, the students became more accustomed to me, and so they wanted me to come to their extracurricular activities, their jobs, their swim meets, football games, you name it, and to their homes. And in the 4 years that I was there, I ended up going to one student's funeral because he was killed. But what I learned was that education still takes place, though with a lot of distractions, and teachers still teach, students still learn, but it's just a lot more difficult than when I was a student, certainly when you were a student, and it's something that parents need to be aware of so that they can try to get the most out of the education of their kids. It wasn't just with Alice Bennett. I was with her their freshman year, then moved to Beatrice McKendra, the student's sophomore year. She was an English teacher. And then was with Scott Milkowart, an American history teacher. their junior year, and then with Dennis Bobbitt, the student's senior year. So it gave me an understanding of the different techniques of teaching from different professionals, but also the different types of classes and how the students fared. And then I stayed with the kids even after they graduated so that I would report on just how they were doing either in college or in jobs or just in the community.
You are so right. I mean, I got to see it firsthand as a parent. I was essentially the PTA. I was the parent liaison. I was the head of the PTA, which then in turn moved to me being elected to the school board here in Kansas City. And it is so critical for parents to be involved and engaged. One of the quotes that has stuck with me today is I had four kids in four different schools, but I would make sure parent-teacher conference time, I went to talk to all 28 teachers.
Absolutely.
And the teachers would sit and say, you're the parent that I don't need to see. The parents that I need to see are the parents that don't come. Right. But if something happens to their son, then our daughter, or if they fell out, then that's when I hear from them. And as a board member, I'm an alumni of Central. I would go to Central High School, and there was a young man my first year on the board, and he's like, I am the greatest basketball player in my neighborhood, in my community. I don't need to do this. I'm going straight to the NBA. And I said, young man, you got six D's and an F.
Right.
I said, there's no more things like Kobe Bryant where you go straight to the NBA. Now you have to go do 1 year worth of college. You've got to have a minimum of a 2.0 GPA in college. How do you get past that? Those stories and those realities. And his mother was sitting there, and I explained to him, and his mother said, he's telling you the right thing. You know, you can't go do what you think you're going to do because right now you don't have the tools. And one of the most heartbreaking things is that one of the students who graduated from Kansas City, Missouri Public School District was the greatest. He was the best basketball player in the state at the time. And he ended up going to junior college.
Right.
And a time when parents need to check in and be at the school the most is in high school when your child is starting to look at those different things, you know, where they want to go. And as parents are beginning to give them that latitude and that freedom, they should be there at least once a month talking to those teachers, having an email with those teachers, because now it's more critical that, and what parents don't understand is that the valedictorian is based off of seven quarters, not eight. The middle of the senior year, when they come back from break and that second semester starts, that's when they stop everything to looking at who's going to be class ranking, valedictorian, and everything else. So those are things that, those are times when your children need you the most. They don't need you to step back, they need you to step up.
I completely agree. And I think that one of the things that is a problem is that our kids, particularly African-American kids, see musicians, rappers, athletes, football players, basketball players, and somewhat baseball players, and they think that that's the way for them to succeed, make a lot of money. But we need to help them to understand that, number one, the athletes, the super athletes that they see on television are also super smart, and that they've done well in school, and they wouldn't be where they are unless they had the intellect to be able to play the game exceptionally. It's not about just physical prowess, but you have to be smart. Number two, they need to hear what some of the athletes have said in, I'm a member of the Trotter Group of Black Voices in Commentary, and we would get together once a year and meet it in different places and then have people come in and talk to us. Well, we had one guy who played for the NFL, and he told us point blank, he said, the NFL actually stands for not for long, because you're not going to have a very long career. You might make a lot of money, but then it's gone, and then you have to have something else that you need to fall back on, and that's where the student's education comes in hand. with the guy who you mentioned who wanted to play the basketball for the NBA, he needs to understand that that should stand for New Broom Athlete. So, because those are the only positions that individuals who don't have an education will be able to do, and that's to sweep the floor for some janitorial service. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that if you want to be more and better, you've got to have an education. And we need to expose our kids to other professions so that they don't just make a judgment on what they want to be based on what they see on TV.
And you are so correct, because Michael Jordan honed his game in North Carolina through 3 years, which made him a number one draft pick. You know, Stephen Curry went to Davidson, small college, and everybody said he was too small, he wasn't big enough, he wasn't durable enough, he had ankle injuries, but he's now worth over $200 million, but he also went back and got his college degree. You know, you look at Shaq, you look at all these people, Charles Barkley, Bo Jackson, all of these people, they may have thought were not smart, were ended up being smart, and then they bucked the trend. On top of that is that they've been retired more than 20 years, and they've got companies. Bo has a company. Shaq is worth $400 million plus and owns Papa John's and different things. But also there's one other thing that, from looking at them, that Patrick Mahomes does is they all give back.
Right.
And Shaq said, I don't go to a Walmart without buying somebody else something. They showed him on one of his trips, and he was buying something, and he saw a young man in the store and said, well, do you want a bicycle? And he said, you know, I'll buy you a bike if your mom says it's okay. He showed him on video. He goes back there. He picks the little young man picks his bike. Shaq takes it up to the front and told him, you know, it's important when you get to where you're going to give back. This experience at Washington High School led to you writing a book in 2004, A Teacher's Cry, Expose the Truth About Education. How critical is education in the role of our children, regardless of whether they're black, white, Hispanic, where they come from in this nation, but how important is education?
Well, let me go back.
Go ahead.
Just for a bit, because being away from the Star and keeping up with the news has allowed me to be able to finally read a lot of books. And so I've read the 1619 Project. And what's phenomenal to me is what that book brings to our attention that we didn't previously know. I did not know that we owe public schools in this country, which started in the 1800s, to African-American slaves being freed, and then suddenly they had a great need for education, and so schools were developed for the slaves, but it also led to the development of public schools for white people too. So we owe public education in this country to the freedom that slaves received and then them getting schools. Slaves knew that education was the ticket in this country to so many better things. But you fast forward even further, and there's a book by Larry Tye called Rising from the Rails. And he pointed out, and the book was about the creation of the Pullman Porters and how that happened. Well, Pullman decided that the people who should attend to the wealthy who rode the trains should be former slaves who were in the houses, who kept the confidence of their masters and wouldn't talk. And so these were the people who he hired for the Pullman Porter's car. They didn't make a lot of money, but they were individuals who were very good at what they did. But they also picked up on the lifestyles of people who were wealthy and certainly a part of that elite who could travel the trains. And so they learned from the wealthy that education and college were the ways for their children. And so the Pullman porters took that back to their homes and pressed their kids to not only finish grade school and high school, but to go on to college as well. And so the Pullman porters made up the backbone of the middle class for Black America in the late 1800s on into the 1900s, and they made up the backbone, literally, of the civil rights movement, because they were the individuals who helped to fund it, who helped to provide the bodies of people who became the individuals doing the protests, and filling out the pamphlets and making the signs, etc. So education for African Americans has always been the ticket to salvation or a better life for ourselves and then for our children as well. And I think that somewhere along the line, we have become confused into thinking that education is a bad thing, that it's something that only nerds do. When I would, when I worked for the newspaper, I would be asked to go into schools and talk to the kids about the value of their education. And I would tell them that, look around, look at the cool kids, the ones that you think are the cool kids in your class. And then look at the nerds, the people who you think are just worthless now. I said the cool kids will end up working for the nerds later in life. And you need to understand that to understand which ones you want to be now, so that when you get to where you're my age, then you'll know that you've chosen well.
You're so correct, because you're not there. There's, yes, being well-rounded is important because it gives you experiences that you wouldn't have gotten. But you have to turn around and take your studies seriously. That's one thing that when I talked to kids when I was on the school board, and you know, and then unfortunately, it's a factor that is discriminatory in some cases, because when I was running, one of the things, I went to a neighborhood meeting and I was talking to somebody, and one of the residents there said, I don't even know why he's here, because he's probably just another uneducated person trying to game and get a position for himself. And in my mind, I said, okay, either I can either take this or I can tell the truth. And it led to me developing a model of, like, I'm not for lease, I'm not for loan, I'm not for sale, but I told the truth. And I said, sir, you are all right. He said, you probably don't have a college degree. I said, you're correct. I don't have a college degree. I have 4 college degrees, and I was taught my PhD. And everybody in the room went, whoa. And my college that I went to was a small private college that, by the grace of God, the military helped me with. I graduated with no student loan debt. And they gave out little small copies of certificate, and I've always carried it in my billfold. And I said, I have my degree certificates in my billfold if you would like to see them. And sometimes you have to, it wasn't about trying to make him feel old, but it was about validating and letting him know that the experience that he was projecting on me was incorrect, and letting other people know that I'm not going here not based off of experience, but I'm also a parent, and I'm going here based on not only my children, but your children. So you were exactly correct.
One of the other things that I do when it comes to education, particularly when I get asked to go in and speak to students, is to show them the value of their education and to help them to understand it in ways that all kids can get. We have marketed everything to our kids from the moment they can sit up and watch TV to going on the small screens and becoming social media savvy. And so they understand money, and they understand that that's what they want more of in life. So what I do, and I've been doing this for more than 20 years, is that I go into schools and I pull out my wallet and say that every day your teacher comes into class, what she's doing is taking out a $50 bill and she's laying it down in front of every student and saying, if you're smart, you'll pick it up. And that $50 is what consists of reading, math, spelling, social science, science, all of the history, all of the things that are taught in school. And so it's an accumulation of intellectual capital. And the money is financial capital. And at the end of the day, every student should have picked up $50 in intellectual capital. And at the end of the week, it's $250. At the end of the month, it's $1,000. And I ask the students, as I put down a 50, well, here's for Monday, there's for Tuesday, there's for Wednesday, there's for Thursday, there's for Friday. I say, how much is on the floor now? And they get very animated, very excited, and they understand that that's $250 on the floor in front of them, and it's real money. And some of them try to get up and jump at it, and I put my foot on it and say, no, that's mine. And I'm trying to illustrate to you the value of your education. And at the end of a month, it's $1,000. At the end of the year, it's $9,000 in intellectual capital that they should have picked up. And you start adding the years together, and by the end of 9 years, that's kindergarten through eighth grade, that's $81,000 in intellectual capital that students should have picked up. You add sophomore year and or freshman year and sophomore year, then it bumps up to $99,000. So at the end of your sophomore year, you start taking your college entrance exams, ACT, SAT. All they are measuring is how much in intellectual capital did you pick up. If you didn't pick up much, your scores will be low. If you picked up all of it, your scores will be high. And that high score means that the colleges will come to you and pay you to come to their school. And so your education then is based on the intellectual capital that you picked up or didn't. And the nerdy kids will have picked up a lot, and they'll get to go free, in some cases, to the school of their choice. And then after they graduate from college, then the recruiters will come, and that intellectual capital gets converted to real capital again, because they'll pay you a lot of money to come work for them. And so if our kids are able to see how their education translates into real money, and the step-by-step process that's required, then I think it gives them a clearer idea of what they need to do as a student to collect all of that intellectual capital.
You are so correct in that. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI. This is Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. And today we're talking with Lewis Dugood, who is a newspaper columnist, author, and he worked at the Star for 39 years. So stay tuned right back after this short break. We're back. This is Joseph Jackson hosting Cowtown Conversations on 90.1 FM. And our guest today is Lewis W. Dugood. And he is a newspaper columnist. He was a newspaper columnist and an author of three books. And he worked at the Star for over 39 years. So stepping back to education one more time, how critical is it? A lot of our parents don't know what they don't know. And education has changed. Before it was, when you grew up and I grew up, it was reading, writing, and arithmetic. Now it's reading, being a part social worker. You are having to, we've had two different six-year-olds bring guns to classes. And if you don't, and we're gonna later in the year, we're going to talk about that a little bit more, but if you want to see the disparity, the first young man was not a minority. His parents they've had the ability to get a lawyer. Nobody's in jail. And he shot somebody. He actually shot his teacher.
The second young man was a six-year-old. The gun never even made it to the classroom. He was African-American. The mother is in jail now. Unfortunately, she's having to deal with a public defender, which means in our community, we don't get the best legal representation. We just get representation. So you're seeing two different versions and visions. But how critical is it for parents to sit and say, if my child wants to be able to get out of the situation that he's in and have a different outcome in his lifetime, that I be involved and engaged, you know, social media, popping up to see the teacher, different things like that. And when they come home, reinforce those lessons, you know, homework, get those things done. Because if they don't, then the future of the child is not as bright as it could be.
Our children, Joseph, our little recording devices, they pick up on everything that we do and say, even when we think they're not really taking in all of what we are doing. They're watching us. They're listening to us. They're mocking us. They're wanting to be like us. I learned with my own daughters and when they were infants that it's important that the parent understand that they are the first and best teachers for young people. And so it's critical to look at the kids as a little slate. And we have to write on that slate deep and strong so that the values that we hold dear become those that really guide their lives, because there will be all of this noise that will come in and want to script over what we've written. But if we've done our job and we've not really produced all of these mixed messages, then they'll be okay. Now, if we value guns and we show a reverence for weaponry, then that's what the kids will pick up. If we don't, that's what the kids will pick up. And so it's critical for the parents to not surrender the role of giving our young people these essential values, because if we surrender, then it becomes what they value. And to keep guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them, and children should not have firearms, then it's important for the parents also not to have firearms. I mean, you have to understand that there are more guns in this country now than there are people, which makes no sense, because there are people like me who don't own guns, but that means that other people own way, way, way too many. And guns are a problem. They are an instrument of pseudo power. They give people the feeling that they are in charge, and it's just a weapon that can lead to so many other problems.
Lewis, in 2017, you wrote another book, Our Fathers, Making Black Men, which focuses on one black man, your dad in St. Louis, and how he raised you all. And one of the things you said, it takes a village to raise a child. We have moved away from that, because it used to be if you got in trouble on your block, you got a whipping before you got home, and you dare you say, I'm gonna tell my mama and daddy, because you wasn't gonna tell your mama and daddy, because when and your neighbor would tell you, don't worry about, I'm gonna call your mama and daddy, and they'd be waiting for you when you got there. Now you touch somebody's child, I'm gonna sue, you're gonna do these things. You know, how do we get back to a point of being able to raise our men in a community to where a situation where they're gonna have to have those resources, those networks, those connections? Those are things that you learn as a child. How do we get back to that point?
That's I think the $64,000 question, Joseph. when I was growing up. I'm 67, so born in 1955. And I distinctly remember I had followed my older brother, who's a year older than I am, down the street and around the corner, and we were hopelessly lost. Well, I was still in a diaper, and he was someone who I would follow to the ends of the earth. And I remember, I mean, we talk about how the neighbors would give us a whipping, but the neighbors also guided us, helped us. I remember distinctly, couldn't have been more than 2 or 3 years old, this black woman leaned out the window. "Baby, what's wrong? I see y'all crying. What can I do? How can I help?" And it was that guidance that kept us still, that allowed our mom to be able to come and retrieve us. But that kind of closeness is really disintegrated. There's a great book written by Robert Putnam called Bowling Alone, and I quote him in my second book, Discovering the Real America. And he talked about how the social capital in this country has been disintegrating since the 1950s. And that social capital is the knitting of individuals to look out for one another. It's a sense of community, a sense of togetherness, and the reciprocity that comes from it. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. But it's disintegrated because of the way in which we have come to live our lives. We have moved out of the city into the suburbs. We've moved into homes that no longer have front porches. We've moved into places where the garage door goes up and the car backs out in the morning. The garage door goes up and the car comes in the evening, and then you don't see your neighbors. You don't see anybody because we're all cocooned in these places. And then we're spending more time actually getting from we're commuting from our work or from our jobs to work and then commuting back again. So it can be an hour lost, and that's an hour of connectivity that also is lost. He mentions that we're playing cards with each other less. We're having dinner parties less. We're having a family over less. We're bowling alone more, whereas people used to bowl in leagues. So that connectivity is gone. We're spending more time with the media, either watching TV or the small screens or doing other things that are really directed at some electronic device, and we're not engaged with one another, not learning from one another, not bouncing ideas and our sense of who we are and what we should value off of one another. We're voting less, and we're giving less of a care about the community in general. And this disintegration, again, has been going on for decades, and it continues. So the more we are tied to the media and getting our sense of self and well-being from the media, the more pulled apart we become. Now, I think that the coronavirus made things worse because there we had to wear the mask, which hide a huge part of our face, and that's information that we can get from engaging with other people. We had to social distance. We had to stay at home, work at home, so that's less of a chance to be engaged with one another. But then we, when we pull apart, we also have less to talk about, and we feel more uncertain about our own ideas and our own sense of self, and less willing to share. And it's why we are so polarized now as a country, because people are either in this camp watching Fox, or they're in this camp watching MSNBC, or another camp with CNN. And the media are feeding to us the things that reinforce our own belief rather than giving us information and ideas that help to expand and want us to get with people who may be different.
And you've hit on a lot of things there. The small screen, the smartphone, the tablet. When I was a kid, we would go outside and you'd go play, and you knew your friends up the block, your friends down the block. You know, you knew who got in trouble that week, who couldn't go out to play, so whose house you wouldn't go to.
Exactly.
But also what we had was we had mentors and role models. You know, it wasn't Michael Jordan. It wasn't watching clips of Michael Jordan on YouTube. You know, it was, okay, for me it was one of my neighbors, Mr. Price. He was retired from the Air Force, and I didn't even know what the Air Force was when I was 9. You know, but having conversations with him when I went to church, it was talking with the pastor, Earl Abel. I went to Palestine at the time. You know, we had a young men's group, and it was different men there. We were all African-American, and there were different places, and we had mentors and role models. Now, our kids kind of grow up, but they don't have – that role model may be Kanye, unfortunately, or somebody else, you know, Floyd Money Mayweather. There may be somebody that has really gotten there, but they're on a different level, and they don't have that same path and seeing those same situations and circumstances our kids may be seeing. Mm-hmm. How critical is it that we begin to sit down and have that conversation with our children, say, let's put the screen away. These are things, you know, have the – you probably did it. Your dad had that conversation with you, being a young African American male, especially when you started to drive. Different things you do, things you don't do, and things you definitely make sure that you don't do.
Absolutely. Dad would not only do that with my siblings and I, but he would pull kids off the street. They come knock on the door of his chemical company and ask for some change. And he'd say, well, I don't have any money to give you, but I will give you a job. And so he would let them in his company and then put them to work. Same as he did with sweeping the floor, and then his company produced different products. And so we would work with him to put the bottles on the table, label the bottles, and then fill the bottles, and then put them in the boxes, and then take them back into the warehouse and stack them up, and then prepare orders for shipping to companies all over the U.S. And so he then worked with not only us, my siblings and I, but then a whole host of kids who lived in the neighborhood, and teach them the value of hard work, teach them the value of knowing what to do next, and how this is a process that is the essence of life, and not running up and down the street and talking a lot of BS, but being about something that matters. But then he would also teach them how they should value their school, value the education that they get, do better in school, and then reward the students who were on the street when they came in with a good report card and showed it to them, so that there was this positive reinforcement constantly. And you're right, we are missing that element of mentoring. Number one, there aren't as many mom and pop businesses that had existed when I was a kid, when you were a kid, that are in place in the Black community that can do that for kids. But then number two, there aren't as many people who live in these communities who will engage young people. They're afraid of a lot of young people because of what they see in the media, and then with all of the noise that sometimes exists on the streets that is unstructured. Involvement of just folks out making a lot of noise and not really being about something that's good.
As we close out, Lewis, this is our first conversation. We have many topics, and I have enough material that we're going to do. I definitely want to have you back to talk about one of the stories you did about homelessness and going undercover about that, but also back to talk about, we're going to talk about diversity and inclusion and race. So I want to have you back a couple more times a year. But as we close out on this segment,
What would you like to leave with our with our listeners on different things they can do to, you know, change and be more a part of their community? Because as another thing is that you wrote about is that it's all about community engagement and community involvement.
Well, I think that something that I picked up and put into my first book on education is critical here, and that is, to paraphrase Gandhi, we must be the change we wish to see in the world. And if we are not engaged, if we are not being that model that really helps young people to understand that there's something better out there for them, then we're not as doing as much as we should be doing to really make this a better world.
And I would love to thank Lewis for being our guest today on Cowtown Conversations. We're never in Cowtown Conversations without a community minute. Folks, the Negro League Museum is free until the end of February due to Royals Charity. So if you've never been there off of 18th and Vine, this is a great time to go out with your children, your sons, your daughters, and they can see some different things. Today, Councilman Brandon Ellington is doing his food giveaway at 3634 Brooklyn from 10 a.m. to noon. So if you know somebody that needs something, show up 10 a.m. to noon or until supplies run out and they will give food. The play by Michelle Tyreen Johnson, Only One Day a Year, will be playing at the Coterie until March the 5th. And something that Lewis talked about, many people may not know, early voting is open in Kansas City for the April 4th election, which traditionally is a low turnout election. So if you want to make your voice heard, you can go out now and you can cast your vote. There will be no lines, no muss, no fuss. On April 4th, you can go on and do what you want to do. So it's definitely a situation that, you know, our voice is our vote. If we don't exercise our vote, then we don't exercise our voice, and other people will have the ability to do some things. So, and it, what other people want to do and what we would want to see done is not things that actually get done. So definitely those are things that you want to do, you know, if you're voting, and let your friends know. So for Cowtown Conversations, I've been your host, Joseph Jackson. Folks, next week I have a show that just like this one that I ended the month with a bang. I have the director of the Greenwood Rising Room Museum in Tulsa, Oklahoma, from Black Wall Street, and he has a Kansas City connection. He is the former vice president of the Negro Leagues baseball museum. So tune in next week. We're gonna all learn a lot. So for Cowtown Conversations, been your host, Joseph Jackson. Have a great day, stay safe, and stay tuned for Signal to Noise.
90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City, Community Radio. Streaming online at www.kkfi.org.
Well, good morning, everyone. Happy Thursday. The weekend is almost upon us. The name of this show is Signal to Noise. I'm Barry.